In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about women's health. This is something that we do once a month on the program, and our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's also on the faculty of the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign, and for a long time we've been doing this as one of those numbers of things that we do monthly because we decided to, a long time ago, that people would always have questions, and it would be a good thing to do on a regular basis. She generally does indeed stop by here on a Monday, but not this Monday. It's a little bit off the usual schedule and not the regular time, but we do try to make sure that we do have the guests on, these regular guests on every month. Sometimes we have to rearrange the schedule a little bit to make that possible. And we're glad that she could be here once again with us. She's usually here on the fourth Monday at 10. At any rate, same topic as always. If you have questions, and she comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new in the field or perhaps something that you would find interesting. But the reason for doing these programs also, in addition to hearing what she has to say, is to give listeners a chance to ask questions. So whatever might be on your mind, as long as it falls within her area of practice, and we've talked about a lot of different things over time, whatever's on your mind, I know that she will do her best to help you out. I always try to make sure that people keep in mind when we have physicians on the program that we cannot diagnose over the telephone. There are limits to what we can do, but we do these programs to add to your health knowledge. It's a place you can start, maybe ask some basic questions, and then if you have concerns, of course, you need to take them up with your own physician or someone who can see you. In any case, questions are welcome, and we have somebody right here ready to go, and we'll get right to them in just a moment. Let me give you the numbers in case you don't know. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the basic number. We do also have a toll-free number, and that would be for you if it would be a long-distance call. You're listening from around Illinois, Indiana, even somebody listening on the Internet. As long as you're in the United States, you may also use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Let's go ahead and talk with our first caller, someone in Urbana. And actually, we have a couple of people here, both of them in Urbana, but we'll start with line number one. Right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question about a daughter with an abnormal pap smear and what the next step is and what sort of things to, what questions to ask the physician.
Okay. Is this a teenager or somebody in her 20s?
She's in her 20s.
She's in her 20s. Well, we classify abnormal pap smears by what's called the Bethesda system. And the pap smears are either very slightly abnormal, so slightly abnormal that the people reading the slide out can't say whether it's really significant or not. And they term the slide ASCUS, A-S-C-U-S, which is atypical squamous cells with undetermined significance, which is sort of a nickname for, well, can't really call it normal, can't really call it dysplastic. And then the next two categorization is dysplasia, but a very low risk type of change, so a very early change. And then the next categorization is a more high grade abnormality, and finally pap smear indicative of cancer, which would be very unusual for somebody in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Most women in their 20s have an abnormal pap due to the virus called the human papillomavirus.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's just a slightly atypical test, very often what they can do is a reflexive HPV test if it was done on a liquid-based pap. If not, if it was a slide test, they have to bring the patient back to actually sample the cervix once again, and they can do a virus test. If it's an ASCUS pap with a negative virus test, very often the physician will either ignore it or maybe there's a minor infection, something like that. If it's a abnormal pap with a positive HPV test, usually the next step is colposcopy. And for all the higher grade abnormalities, the next step is colposcopy, where the physician brings the patient in and essentially looks at the cervix under the microscope to determine areas to biopsy, and it's the actual biopsy which then determines the diagnosis and guides the treatment.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a trend towards more conservative treatment of younger patients, meaning that we are more likely to do colposcopies and follow the patient out in case she might resolve these problems on her own rather than surgically remove the areas. Experimentally, there have been a number of vaccine and vaccine-like treatments. These aren't, wouldn't be available to her right away, but we're investigating even non-surgical ways, in other words, medicines that could be used to help reverse these changes, because removing any or part or a large or small part of the cervix can impact on future fertility and pregnancies. It's not necessary that the patient's going to have an adverse consequence, but it's common enough that with young patients, we try to manage more what we call expectantly. And that's where going to more than one doctor sometimes can get slightly divergent opinions as to what should happen next. But if you know nothing else other than an abnormal pap, usually most patients do wind up getting that colposcopy.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to
mention one other thing, and I don't know if our caller is still listening, but in the state of Illinois, we have the Breast and Cervical Cancer Prevention Program, and it is administered by the Public Health Department, and they not only pay for pap smears for lower to mid income women, but they can also pay for colposcopies. So there are ways to get those very important tests funded if you do not have health insurance that would cover those tests. And I think that's a big benefit to the women of Illinois and something that patients should look into if they don't have good insurance.
Okay. Next caller is line two and in Urbana right here. Hello.
I have two questions, and I'll put them in the order of importance, depending on how much time you have. One is, would you talk about estring, which is the estrogen in the cervical ring, insertable ring? And then some time ago, a couple years ago maybe, I heard you talking about women and smoking and estrogen and how estrogen receptors interact with nicotine, and it's harder for women to quit. And I've been telling women friends about this, and I'm not certain I have the story completely straight now, because it's been a while since I heard it, and I haven't seen it written down someplace. So do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, maybe. There is quite a bit known about estrogen and smoking. In general, estrogen levels are lower in smokers, so that smokers have a slightly earlier menopause, and that they're at a greater risk, therefore, for various kinds of conditions, including osteoporosis. Also, smokers actually may have a slightly lower blood level when they take birth control pills, so that their birth control pills may be more likely to cause spotting and breakthrough bleeding, and secondarily, more likely to fail on smokers. Smoking is very hard to quit, as we've all discovered, and there are many, many nicotine receptors in the brain. I don't remember ever having said that estrogen changes the numbers of receptors in the brain, or that estrogen makes it harder for smokers to quit. That I don't really remember. One of the more controversial things I do talk about with estrogen levels in smokers is, being that the estrogen levels are lower, smokers have a slightly reduced risk of breast cancer because of that. Because in general, we have the high estrogen state person who tends to be a little more at risk of breast cancer and lower risk for osteoporosis. And then the flip side, we've got the relatively lower estrogen group, and they are more likely to have osteoporosis, and they are a little bit less likely, therefore, to have breast cancer. So if you're more at risk for one, you're a little bit less risk for another. Doesn't mean that there's not a person out there who couldn't have both, but just as in general. But I think I must have taken your questions out of order. Sorry. But
the smoking, hang on for a second. What I recall you're saying was something to the effect, and I could be misremembering this, was that nicotine interacted with estrogen receptors, and that it was harder for women to quit for that reason, and if you timed when you started quitting with your menstrual cycle, it seemed to me that you had to do it maybe when you started your period or just after, because if you could get 6 weeks in, you're more likely to be successful. Now, obviously, women's menstrual cycles aren't 6 weeks long, but if you tried to start at certain times of your menstrual cycle, you'd have you'd be less likely, it'd be much harder to quit because of the hormonal fluctuations. And so, and if you could get started at the right time, you'd get 3 weeks in of success. Anyway, that was the gist of some of what I remembered.
Most smoking cessation programs talk about taking 6 weeks for most of the nicotine, at least the majority, to clean out of your lungs. And many people who make it to the 6 week point are very likely to quit. And I think that's where maybe some of the 6 week time frame comes in. Nicotine, what I know chemically about nicotine and what I know about estrogen and where the receptors are, I don't think that those receptors are identical. And I don't remember any information regarding success at quitting relative to the menstrual cycle, but more than just estrogen fluctuates in the menstrual cycle. But it's definitely something I could look up, and I could try to remember to cover it next month. But I don't remember, and it sounds so detailed that it's possible somebody, one of the other physicians that comes onto the show may have talked about it, or maybe it is something I talked about. I just don't remember.
Yeah, it's possible, but I can sort of hear your voice saying it. But anyway, it's possible I must have misremembered.
Hopefully, yeah, I said it right, but I will look it up again because it's just not something I remember. But in terms of the E-string, is there anything specific that you would like to know about E-string?
I just hadn't remembered hearing you talking about it, and I could have just missed a program, so I was just wondering if you would generally talk about the advantages and pros and cons.
Well, when it comes to hormone replacement therapy in menopausal patients, we talk about estrogen as having most of the benefit. In other words, estrogen treating the vasomotor symptoms, estrogen treating some of the sleep disorders, estrogen treating the urogenital atrophy, estrogen also being very important in treating some of the sex drive, sexual dysfunction. And when we talk about patients who need progesterone therapy, those are usually patients who have a uterus and we just need to balance the effects of estrogen on the uterus, and we supplement with progesterone. But taking progesterone for a moment out of the equation, there's a large number of various delivery systems in terms of providing estrogen to menopausal patients. So the most typical is just a pill. And then we have a variety of what we call transdermal, meaning on the skin. So we have creams and we have gels and we have patches as the majority of the transdermal. And then there is various parental type therapies where the delivery is different than even transdermal or oral injections, or what most people know about as the typical kind of medication administered. And then there's vaginal administration. And vaginal administration can be given in a couple of different forms. It can be given with a cream that's just absorbed locally, or it can be given in delivery devices like the E-string, which is an impregnated device that leaks enough estrogen to actually provide not only local levels, but blood levels. And in fact, if you used estrogen cream vaginally on a daily basis in the correct dose, you could get a blood level with that as well. And the E-string is a device that you can wear for 90 days, and it delivers a fairly consistent level. The advantages of any system of estrogen administration other than oral is that you have a very low level of direct effect to the liver. So that for certain groups of patients, we think that oral medication may be a little less advantageous because it may produce clotting factor changes and lipid changes in the liver. And therefore, there might be a group of patients that we think that transdermal is safer. But by and large, particularly now that we're aiming at using lower doses, by and large, all formulations are safe and the delivery is more patient preference and convenience.
OK, Okay, thanks a bunch.
All right, thanks for the call. Our guest this morning here on Focus 580 in this hour is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's with us on the program once a month, usually on the fourth Monday at 10, a little change of schedule this time around, but we wanted to make sure that we did the program. So the idea here is the same as always. If you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have another caller here, someone listening in Champaign, to talk with. Line one. Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Truppen. Thank you for being there. I have a question about hysterectomies. And the first question, and I have a series if there's nobody else waiting on the phone.
Okay.
Yeah, we have no other callers, so
okay,
go ahead.
All right. The first question is about complete hysterectomy, taking out the ovaries as well as the uterus. And for a diagnosis of uterine cancer for a 51-year-old patient, would you recommend also removing the ovaries?
Okay. So your question is that if a patient had been diagnosed with the word uterine cancer, is the correct kind of hysterectomy to take out the ovaries at the same time?
That's the question.
And other than that, was there a second part to that question?
Yeah, the other information was that the patient is 51 years old. I think
okay.
The age is a factor.
Okay. Well, yes and no. Okay. When patients say the word uterine cancer, physicians assume they usually mean what's called endometrial cancer, lining cancer of the uterus. In fact, the uterus has a cervix and it has lining tissue called the endometrium. And of course, it has a body of the uterus called the myometrium. And cancer of the uterus could be cancer of the actual cervix. It could be cancer of the endometrium, and it could be cancer of this myometrium.
Yes, it is endometrial.
Endometrial cancer. Mm-hmm. Okay. And with endometrial cancer, it's usually something diagnosed in older women, so that the average age of diagnosis is more likely to be in the 60s and the 70s. It is usually found in the very early stages because when the cancer occurs, it usually causes uterine bleeding, which leads the patient for diagnosis. And so very often it is caught in the early most stages, which is a condition that is treatable by a form of hysterectomy. Now, usually the endometrial cancer patients are offered various kinds of therapies, but typically you would have a hysterectomy that removes the cervix, that removes the body of the uterus, that does remove the tubes and ovaries, and perhaps is a slightly wider resection, but also might include removing some of the major lymph supply to those areas to detect whether or not the cancer has spread into those lymph glands.
And what's the rationale for removing the ovaries?
Well, endometrial cancers are estrogen dependent, and it's usually considered a complete therapy to remove the ovaries. Now, you may be getting that a little bit mixed up with information on patients having hysterectomies for other reasons. For instance, the most common reason for a woman in the United States to have a hysterectomy is for heavy menstrual bleeding. Now, we have so many other treatments and lots of medicines that can help avoid that. That's almost a whole separate subject, but it's still one of the, mm-hmm. It is still the most common reason. And in those patients, they are presented with a decision as to whether or not to electively remove their ovaries. And many physicians under the age of 40 would not encourage someone to lose her ovaries unless there was something wrong with them. And many physicians in women over the age of 50 will say that the average age of menopause is about 51 and a half, and therefore your own ovary is going to just produce hormones for a short while longer, at least with respect to estrogen, although we do produce male hormones for longer than that. And you have about a 1 in 70 risk of ovarian cancer, and removing the ovaries reduces about 98 to 99% of all cases of ovarian cancer. So you might have an option to electively keep or remove ovaries if you're having a hysterectomy for non-cancer cancerous purposes. But when it comes to endometrial cancers, the cure rate is much higher with ovarian removal, and also they want to be sure that no cancer involves the ovaries, and ovarian removal for endometrial cancer is usually universally recommended.
And in that case where you do have the complete hysterectomy with removal of the ovaries, do you recommend then hormone replacement therapy?
Well, once you've had endometrial cancer and the ovaries are out, and if it's determined that all the cancer has been removed, in other words, the lymph nodes are negative, you don't need any follow-up chemotherapy, and you don't need any follow-up radiation therapy, then that patient is eligible for hormone replacement therapy. But the current thinking with respect to hormone replacement therapy is to use the lowest effective doses for the shortest period of time. And so we would approach that patient like we would approach any other patient, saying, what conditions do you have that need treatment? And if she doesn't have any conditions that need treatment, say she doesn't have hot flashes, she doesn't have a low sex drive, she doesn't have any vaginal dryness, so forth and so on, then she would probably be just followed and not offered immediate estrogen therapy. Unlike a few years ago when we used to think we were beating nature, not being natural with the estrogen therapy.
Hmm. And then if the hormone replacement therapy is recommendable because of all those adverse symptoms that you just mentioned, is there a better form? You were talking with the previous caller about transdermal versus oral versus...
And that's when you have to step back and decide what conditions do you have, what are you hoping to achieve, how severe are the conditions, and what delivery systems might be most effective. For instance, for somebody that is overweight and already has high cholesterol, maybe they would be somebody who really would be a better candidate for transdermal. Other patients might just have the option of the different delivery systems.
Mm-hmm.
It being that it's summertime, we like to not get those patches exposed to sun. Turns out that can affect their drug delivery as well as sometimes even cause darkening of the skin that can't be reversed. So there are little things like that we do take into consideration.
It seems sometimes that the more books I read, the more confusing everything is. But one of the books that I read that perhaps you are aware of is a Suzanne Summers book.
Yes.
And she just goes on and on about how your hormones are just related to your overall well-being and health, and if you've had complete hysterectomy, that you should have hormone replacement therapy. Do you agree with that?
Well, that one isn't a question that you can almost answer in a short way. Much of what she writes is what we call subjective, and she's not really standing back and giving you a overview of the risks and benefits. She's not really talking about the science behind the information. She's talking with respect to how she feels. She's talking from a very narrow perspective and not a broad one. And
have interviews with endocrinologists and other doctors in the book.
She does. Yeah. And but still, it's what we call level 3 evidence. It's just one person's testimony. And it's not what we call level 1 evidence, where we talk about the risks and benefits. And we know that that many people can indeed benefit from hormone therapy. But the current evidence is that if you don't have a condition to treat, that over time particularly, you may be causing more harm than good. For instance, some people, if you treat them with estrogen, will just and then want to get off. They're going to go through some of that same withdrawal kinds of symptoms that they would have earlier, but they're just going to go through it later. So some of these things we have to work out, and we have to take it within the context of their own best health, so that, you know, if you're already sleeping well, are you going to sleep better? Probably not. Everybody in your family lives to 100. Are you going to live longer? Well, probably not. If you're already having a good sex life, is it going to be better? Well, probably not. So we take people who have specific conditions that need treatment and remember that this is pharmacologic therapy with risks and benefits, and trying to still do research studies on the lowest effective dose and how much combination therapy. Is it just estrogen that people need, or is it estrogen and testosterone? And is it really better to have a pill, or is maybe transdermal gel better than, say, transdermal patches? And these are all studies that I'm participating in, that many researchers are participating in, to really answer the question rigorously for you as an individual. And what Suzanne Summers is doing is she's gathering, she's telling a good story, and it's not necessarily medically correct for everyone.
Yeah, but isn't that what we do generally? We say, well, something's happened to me. Don't you check out what happened to somebody else, and how did that work for you? And everybody is different, so every medicine affects everybody differently, and you can only know how it's affecting somebody by asking how they feel.
Well, yes and no. That is true. There are other ways to judge the effectiveness. For instance, if we're treating bones, we can look at bone density. If you're on estrogen and we're worried about what, say, your cholesterol is doing, we can do a blood test for that. So
there
are actual medical ways of monitoring hormone replacement therapy and trying to tailor that and fine-tune it and really understand who can truly benefit has been something that's pretty complex.
Do you have another call waiting, or can I
do actually?
Okay. Well, can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Once you've started hormone replacement therapy, how in the world do you know how long you should continue?
Well, that's been a subject of great debate, but generally speaking, for most of my patients, women in their 50s are probably, who are on it, are probably going to continue to need it. And very few women in their 80s, 90s are going to need it. And many women in their 60s and 70s are not going to need therapy. So somewhere within that time frame, depending on the individual, her continued health, her what other medical conditions have crept in, and to some extent, for some women, all it means that we have to have a drug holiday and see how she feels off. And sometimes we get a lot of clues. Like some people who just miss one pill notice symptoms by the next morning.
Yeah.
Those patients are probably not ready to come off hormone therapy.
Okay.
But other people who accidentally go away on a two-week vacation, don't take their medicines, and don't notice a single symptom, those are probably patients who may want to try off. And it is an individual kind of decision, and also it depends on what we were treating to begin with.
Right.
And also knowing what the right combination. We use a lot less testosterone than they use in either Europe or Canada, and I think that's going to be something that we're going to change. They also have drugs in Europe that have, there's a drug called Tibolone that has androgen types effects, progesterone and estrogenic, and it's a very popular menopausal therapy, and we don't have that in the United States either. So there are going to be a lot of different therapies, and also these designer compounds where we're trying to get the best of estrogen effects, in other words, good bones, without some of the side effects. So that's kind of what we're working on.
Well, thank you so much. You've been very patient.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
All right.
We do certainly have room for others. And if you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, you can give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also toll-free, 800-222-9455. We don't have any callers right at the moment. And I know that you came prepared with a few things that you want to talk about. You want to pick one and...
Sure. Sorry. I was going to talk about heavy menstrual bleeding, and it's a somewhat good segment into the topic of hysterectomies. In the United States, very often we have placed patients on oral contraceptive therapy to control heavy periods, and then we've gotten into a lot of surgical alternatives, and we talked about balloon therapy, where actually a heated balloon is placed within the uterus to essentially burn out the lining tissue of the uterus, which is a very effective and a very low-risk procedure in terms of controlling heavy periods. but patients can't get pregnant again afterwards. So it's certainly not a therapy for everyone, and it doesn't always work in every case. And in other countries, as many as 60 countries around the world, and even over the counter in places like Sweden, is a medication that is used to dissolve clots locally in the lining of the uterus and therefore control heavy periods. And this is a medicine that's now undergoing testing in the United States and shows a lot of promise. And it's a medicine that patients can take just when they have their heavy period. So it's not like being on the birth control pill where you actually have to take a medicine every single day and take a hormone that it can affect all the systems in your body, but you just take it on the days when you have heavy bleeding. So if you have two really heavy days that you flood, you just take it for those couple of days. And if you have 4 or 5 days of heavy bleeding, you take it for those 4 or 5 days. So we're kind of excited. This is going to be something new and a non-surgical alternative. And I think that it will potentially be something effective for American women as it has been in other places.
How much variability in bleeding do you expect? And would you expect a lot variability, say, from one day to the next, from one period to the next? And does it get to a point where if there's a really wide variability, or if perhaps a woman is used to a certain amount of bleeding and it doesn't change for a long, long time, and then at some point she starts to experience really heavy periods and she would say, gee, you know, for me, this is really unusual.
Right.
Is that a sign that there may be some sort of something going on that you want to check in with your doctor?
Absolutely. And new onset heavy periods could mean you have a polyp. It could mean that you have a fibroid. And we were talking about endometrial cancer. It certainly can mean that there is a cancer. It can mean that there's endometriosis or some kind of pelvic infection. So the first step is to be evaluated that way. There are other things that can cause heavy bleeding. Just like aspirin thins your blood, sometimes it can produce heavier periods. So there are other things to look into. And first, you have to have an accurate diagnosis before you come up with the treatment.
Okay, let's talk with another caller here, someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I had a continuation of a question about going off of hormone therapy replacement, or replacement therapy. A couple of years ago when the news came out about this not baby being so good for you overall, I did try to taper off, and it worked for a while, and then I started getting hot flashes again. I'm 74. I would like to try it again. How gradual should a person be?
Well, in the beginning, we only did studies to put patients on therapy, and physicians, their plan was to keep patients on therapy. And most of the research had to do with ways that physicians can communicate benefit to their patients and communicate to their patients to stay on therapy. And very few studies, essentially none, prior to when those studies came out, were ever done in terms of the effectiveness of stopping therapy. Mm-hmm. A few studies have come out, and what seems to work out is a extremely slow withdrawal. So that what's essentially happened since those studies came out is that many formulations that we've had in the past have now come out in much lower doses. So that for instance, Prempro, which is probably the most popular, was in a 0.625 dosage, and then they came out with a Prempro 0.45, and now they've come out with a Prempro 0.3. And so just from year to year, even switching down till you're on the lowest effective dose, and then from there, getting your physician to come up with a strategy of tapering. But a small percentage of patients in population studies, a small percentage of patients will still have symptoms into their 80s. And so you may be one of those. So not everybody will be able to successfully come off hormone therapy in their 70s. Now, whether or not we're going to really have symptomatic 90-year-olds, most of that hasn't been looked at. But we definitely have studies that show that some 80-year-olds are still symptomatic. So it has to pretty much be individual therapy. And then depending if hormone therapy is still safe for you and it's doing what it's supposed to do, maybe it's not something that's that risky to stay on in your particular case. But if there's another treatment, for instance, if you were just taking it for your bones, maybe there's another treatment. Or maybe you can get on something for your bones and then keep a low enough level of estrogen. So that's what people are looking at. And other combination therapies that allow us to fractionate the dose of estrogen. And every one of my research studies in hormone therapy that we have now is looking at different delivery systems and lower dosage to see if we can take the patients that have symptoms and get them adequately treated under these lower dosages with two things in mind. One, that the lower dosage probably is going to be safer, but two, looking towards being able to get people off, because there have been these new studies that show that it can be very difficult to get people off the therapy once they're on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I Med School once a month. She's here usually on the fourth Monday at 10 o'clock. We've changed the schedule a little bit this time round, but it's the same idea here. If you have questions, you can give us a call. And something else you want to talk about?
Yes, I was going to talk about weight. It's always a good time of the year to talk about weight. And I can't believe all this discussion we've had about hormone therapy. Nobody's complaining about their weight relative to the hormone therapy, although in the studies, most patients do just as well with their weight on or off hormone therapy. And the new studies that have looked specifically at weight relative to forces on your knees and stress and strain on your knees says that for each pound of weight loss, you get a fourfold reduction of stress on your knee. So even very small amounts of weight loss seem to benefit our joints greatly. And I always think that these kinds of concepts are so important, because many patients, when they think about being on a diet, think about being from where they are today to being absolutely skinny. And that hurdle can be so difficult. Whereas all the studies with respect to heart disease, and now here's a good study with respect to joint disease, show that small amounts of weight loss are actually tremendously beneficial, and that small strategies in terms of reducing your calories, particularly relative to your activity, or reducing the fat content so that your overall calorie consumption is lower. All the studies show that small amounts of weight loss are extremely beneficial. So,
And there are certainly studies that shows that if you lose a bunch of weight and then you gain it back again, and you lose it and you gain it back again, that's actually harmful.
You know, they've really not shown that in recent studies. One of the problems, of course, is that if you lose weight, that the number of calories you're expending per day relative to your heavier weight is much less. Mm-hmm. So that once you get to your goal weight, that you can't return to your old weight's calorie consumption, or your body will return to your old weight. And really, the internet has such fabulous calculation tools to calculate your calorie consumption based on your age, based on your sex, based on your activity, and based on your weight, and showing how as we get older and as we weigh less, our calorie consumption has to go down, or we will gain. And they've actually not substantiated that yo-yoing is harmful.
So maybe it's not so bad.
That's an old concept.
Bad. Okay,
got rid of that concept.
Well, it certainly is. It is true that however you do to lose that weight, if that's not, it has to be a kind of a lifestyle, whether it's diet, exercise, lifestyle, whatever, that you can keep doing,
right?
Or else if you go back to what you were doing before, your previous calorie consumption, whatever, then as you say, the weight is going to come back.
So the old never say diet concept, but just a lifestyle change. Yeah. And you really have to be diligent, because we have so much very good, very high calorie food out there.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk with someone here in Sycamore. Line number 4, the toll free line. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have another question about hormone replacement, especially with regard to the pharmaceutically created progesterones. Some time ago, I read that the medroxyprogesterone had the effect of closing the coronary arteries of women who use them. What I'd like to know is, have the pharmaceutical companies been proving that the new generation of progestins that they've been bringing out do not have this effect on coronary arteries?
Well, they haven't really repeated the different studies on coronary arteries in many, many years. And most of that data is what we call preclinical studies. So it's done in non-humans. And so it's hard to know what the absolute effects are in humans, because it's going to really vary depending on your cardiovascular status going in, which is why in the Women's Health Initiative study, where we had women age 63 was their average age, that's going to be a very different cardiovascular person than somebody, say, in her late 40s, perimenopausal, possibly normal amounts of exercise, possibly good cholesterol and normal weight. So you get these different groups of patients and they respond quite differently. Most of the new progesterones that have come out, there's a couple of different categorizations. There's one that's in birth control pills that is more similar to an anti-androgen water pill, but it's not available in the United States for use in menopause. And the other new formulations have sort of been one of those back to the future kinds of things. They've come out with natural progesterone that can be administered for hormone replacement therapy. And the natural progesterone was never able to be used before because when in the formulations that we had it in, when you'd swallow it, your body would completely metabolize it. And it, therefore, before it ever got into your bloodstream as usable progesterone, it would be metabolized out. And now they've done what's called particle technology, microparticles, and they've micronized the progesterone particles so that they can actually be absorbed into the bloodstream as progesterone without being digested, and therefore they have some clinical effect. But they're still very large tablets compared to the synthetic progesterones, and how much better they are in terms of cardiovascular effects hasn't been completely established. Probably the ideal compound would be to achieve the effectiveness of estrogen without even using progesterone. And the main reason we use progesterone is to counterbalance the effects on the lining of the uterus. So that, for instance, one way to do that without swallowing a pill is to put in an intrauterine device in the uterus that has progesterone that's just leaked locally. And so it doesn't affect the bloodstream at all. So, and this is something that is done in Canada and Europe, but in the United States, those IUDs cost so much, and insurance companies only cover them for contraception and not for menopause. So most people can't, it's about $1,000, so people don't afford that. But there are a lot of other alternative delivery systems.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have about 10 minutes in this part of the show. Something else you want to talk about?
Well, I think with respect to the types of progesterone, the other things that we think about is not just the effects on cholesterol, but the effects on other lipids like triglycerides. And in men, triglycerides, a type of blood fat, doesn't seem to be dramatically related to whether or not you have risk for heart disease. But in women, triglyceride levels do seem to be related to whether or not you have risk of heart disease. And with triglycerides, there's actually been a couple of formulations that have been shown to lower your triglyceride level rather than raise it. So this is another aspect of heart health with respect to hormone replacement therapy that we're looking into.
Okay. I think we're getting another caller here lined up, and we will have an opportunity to talk with them. Someone in El Paso, Illinois, on the toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I have a question about a recent release study about both men and women taking vitamin E and taking baby aspirin. And I had heard briefly on your radio station, I believe, about the results weren't very good for the women. Is there some place, some publication commonly available to the public where we could read about that?
Well, there's a lot of information on the web. So most of the big health websites like WebMD or Medscape, eMedicine.com have information. A lot of the big medical sites that have their own health newsletters like Cornell or Mayo Clinic or Harvard, they have a lot of information. There actually is some good information on the National Institute of Health website, and the CDC actually has some information, as well as the FDA. But going to those sites, I find there's so much on there. If I know specifically what I'm looking for and have an address, I do pretty well. But just surfing around, I find they have a lot. So I don't think those are the better areas. And ideally, that's what we use our healthcare provider for, to go in and sit down and find out, what are my risks relative to everyone else? One of the big things that we're pointing at right now is the fact that about half of all patients who have heart attacks did not have elevated cholesterol. Their cholesterol was normal. So the question is, and this is true with strokes and other forms of cardiovascular disease as well. And so the question is, what is causing the problem? And we've been pointing a finger at this substance called cardio-C-reactive protein. And that's a measurement of the inflammation levels in our blood. And it turns out that if you decrease inflammation, you're less likely to have a heart attack or a stroke. And probably this is because you're less likely to have a blockage in the important arteries feeding the brain or the heart. And this is why aspirin probably does work in some patients. It probably decreases the inflammation rate. Now, again, there are patients who aspirin is unsafe, and there are patients, depending on their diet, for instance, grapefruit is very thinning to the blood. If you eat a lot of it, you can actually cause clotting disorders, and there's other herbals. So it starts to get very complicated. But I'm participating in one study that's specifically looking at men, healthy men, age 55 and older, and I'm a gynecologist. I don't examine the men, but we do have internists that do, and doesn't involve a pelvic exam. And we're looking for healthy women age 65 and older for this same study. And specifically, we're looking for individuals who have normal cholesterol, not on any medicine. And that's hard to find because a lot of us have a need to get our cholesterol lowered with medication. So we're looking for individuals with normal cholesterol, and we're looking for whether or not their blood has other evidence of abnormality, and we're seeing if treating those inflammation rates will reduce heart disease. It's a large study that's going to have 15,000 individuals across the United States, so it's kind of exciting. It's a four-year study, essentially. And We're hoping to be able to answer some of these specific questions, but you're absolutely right. What works for men doesn't always work for women, and the types of doses may not work, and there may be other factors. There may be subgroups of women where, say, for instance, vitamin E would be beneficial. And since vitamin E is in so much of our food, perhaps we're not getting that group adequately separated into somebody with deficient vitamin E in their diet versus adequate vitamin E in their diet. So these are all things that are being worked out, and fascinating areas, because reducing heart attacks and stroke will be a big benefit to our population, because this is what kills most of us.
Well, my wife and I each take a vitamin E each day plus a multivitamin. I guess we plan to continue doing that. I don't think it'll hurt anything.
Well, and that's the other thing to consider with consultation with your healthcare provider in terms of your diet. Are there ways that we can get other antioxidants, the DHA, the omega-3 fatty acids? That, I think I talked about that quite a bit in the last radio show I did. And maybe doing those kinds of things, which are in fish oil or fish oil supplements, which actually is fairly high in vitamin E also, are those kinds of things maybe better than the pure supplement ways to go? So there's a lot we still have to figure out, but We're all in there studying it madly so we can come up with real answers.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Well, we are just about at the point that we have to finish. Any last real quick thing that you wanted to talk about?
I think I've pretty much covered it. I know I talked about a lot of our studies, and if anybody ever wants to go to womenshealthpractice.com and sign up to get information, we'd be happy to take your name.
All right. Well, our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen, she is an obstetrician and gynecologist in private practice here in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School once a month. Generally on the fourth Monday, she is here. So is we going to be on our usual schedule in the month of August? Yes, she says.
I think so.
We think so. Well, stay tuned here on Focus 580.